الأبان علي وحسين وحسن.
A puppet government in the heart of Africa.
Part 2.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence-seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the UN session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the UN. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then UN Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the Prime Minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the Prime Minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. We are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
ربنا ربنا.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
ربنا ربنا يا ربنا يا ربنا يا حي ويا قيوم نور قلبنا.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question that, you know, people are kind of curious about, inquisitive about, they kind of ask every now and then. That question is about whether after we die in the hereafter, we will be able to communicate with our relatives who have also passed away or not. Is it because, you know, obviously a lot of us, we love our relatives. We love our spouses, we love our children, we love our father, our mother, our grandchildren, our grandparents. And, you know, and it pains us when they pass away. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they want to meet, once again, meet these people. So the question today is a very simple question, and that's whether this is possible or not in the hereafter. So we can answer this question in a number of different ways, or to explain this in another manner, we can say that this depends on the stage of the hereafter we're speaking of, right? As you know, the hereafter there's a number of different stages that a person must pass through before he finally gets to, where his respective place that he has to go. There's death, then there's the questioning of the grave, and so on and so forth. They're called mawaqif, or the way stations of the hereafter. Oh, so the first stage after death is the stage of the purgatory, or what we call barzakh. According to very reliable traditions, it has been mentioned that the believer, human beings in general, meaning regardless of whether they are believers or unbelievers, after they die in their purgatory, they will meet one another. They will meet, including their relatives. For example, we can, in order to reinforce this, we can refer to one of the traditions mentioned in this regards is the following: Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in his presence, something was mentioned regarding the spirits of the believers. That holy Imam, the sixth Imam alayhi salam, said that the spirits of the believers will meet one another in the purgatory. He said that the spirits of the believers will meet one another. When a person in this gathering, he was amazed by this and said, "Is it possible for people, the believers, to meet one another?" The Imam said, "Yes." He said that they will speak with one another and they will recognize one another. And when they see somebody they know, they will say, "Oh, that is that person, so-and-so, that I knew when I was alive." All right, so this tradition, it clearly indicates that this is something possible. In another tradition, it's been mentioned that the Imam was asked, where are the spirits of the believers? He said, they will be in rooms in paradise. They will see one another and visit one another. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at whether the spirits of the believers will meet one another in the hereafter. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Ya Rabbana Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum Nawwir Qalbana. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Permanent war has cannibalized the U.S. It has created a social, political, and economic morass, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article published under the heading The Permanent War Economy. Stay tuned for more. The United States, as the near-unanimous vote to provide nearly $40 billion in aid to Ukraine illustrates, is trapped in the death spiral of unchecked militarism. No high-speed trains, no universal health care, no viable COVID relief program, no respite from 8.3% inflation, no infrastructure programs to repair decaying roads and bridges, which require $41.8 billion to fix the 43,586 structurally deficient bridges, on average 68 years old, no forgiveness of $1.7 trillion in student debt, no addressing income inequality, no program to feed the 17 million children who go to bed each night hungry, no rational gun control or curbing of the epidemic of nihilistic violence and mass shootings, no help for the 100,000 Americans who die each year of drug overdoses, no minimum wage of $15 an hour to counter 44 years of wage stagnation, no respite from gas prices that are projected to hit $6 a gallon. The permanent war economy, implanted since the end of the Second World War, has destroyed the private economy, bankrupted the United States, and squandered trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. The monopolization of capital by the military has driven the U.S. debt to $30 trillion, $6 trillion more than the U.S. GDP of $24 trillion. Servicing this debt costs $300 billion a year. Americans spent more on the military, $813 billion for fiscal year 2023, than the next nine countries. Americans are paying a heavy social, political, and economic cost for their militarism. Washington watches passively as the U.S. rots, morally, politically, economically, and physically, while other countries extract themselves from the tyranny of the U.S. dollar and the International Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, SWIFT, a messaging network banks and other financial institutions use to send and receive information, such as money transfer instructions. Once the U.S. dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, once there is an alternative to SWIFT, it will precipitate an internal economic collapse. It will force the immediate contraction of the U.S. empire, shuttering most of it, nearly 800 overseas military installations. It will signal the death of Pax Americana. Democrat or Republican, it does not matter. War is the raison d'etre of the state. Extravagant military expenditures are justified in the name of national security. The The nearly $40 billion allocated for Ukraine, most of it going into the hands of weapons manufacturers such as Raytheon Technologies, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing, is only the beginning. Military strategists who say the war will be long and protracted are talking about infusions of $4 or $5 billion in military aid a month to Ukraine. Americans face existential threats, but these do not count. The proposed budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in fiscal year 2023 is $10.675 billion. The proposed budget for the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is $11.881 billion. Ukraine alone gets more than double that amount. Pandemics and the climate emergency are afterthoughts. War is all that matters in the United States of America. This is a recipe for collective suicide. There were three restraints to the avarice and bloodlust of the permanent war economy that no longer exist. The first was the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party, led by politicians such as Senator George McGovern, Senator Eugene McCarthy, and Senator J. William Fulbright, who wrote the Pentagon propaganda machine. The self-identified progressives, a pitiful minority in Congress today, from Barbara Lee, who was the single vote in the House and the Senate opposing a broad, open-ended authorization allowing the president to wage war in Afghanistan or anywhere else, to Ilhan Omar, now dutifully lined up to fund the latest proxy war. The second restraint was an independent media and academia, including journalists such as I.F. Stone and Neil Sheehan, along with scholars such as Seymour Melman, author of The Permanent War Economy and Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War. Third, and perhaps most important, was an organized anti-war movement led by religious leaders such as Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., and Phil and Dan Berrigan, as well as groups such as the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. They understood that unchecked militarism was a fatal disease. None of these opposition forces, which did not reverse the permanent war economy but curbed its excesses, now exist. The two ruling parties have been bought by corporations, especially military contractors. The press is anemic and obsequious to the war industry. Propagandists for permanent war, largely from right-wing think tanks lavishly funded by the war industry along with former military and intelligence officials, are exclusively quoted or interviewed as military experts. NBC's Meet the Press aired a segment on May 13th where officials from Center for New American Security, CNAS, simulated what a war with China or Taiwan might look like. The co-founder of CNAS, Michel Flourney, who appeared in the Meet the Press war game segment and was considered by Biden to run the Pentagon, wrote in 2020 in Foreign Affairs that the U.S. needs to develop the capacity and capability to credibly threaten to sink all of China's military vessels, submarines, and merchant ships in the South China Sea within 72 hours, unquote. The handful of anti-militarists and critics of empire from the left, such as Noam Chomsky, and the right, such as Ron Paul, have been declared persona non grata by a compliant media. The liberal class has retreated into boutique activism, where issues of class, capitalism, and militarism are jettisoned for cancel culture, multiculturalism, and identity politics. Liberals are cheerleading the tension and crisis in Ukraine. At least, the inception of the war with Iraq saw them join significant street protests. The new conservatives and liberal interventionists chant in unison for war. Biden has appointed those warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier, to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Biden has appointed these warmongers, whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier, to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Since all people do is war, all proposed solutions are military in the United States. This military adventurism accelerates the decline, the defeat in Vietnam, and the squandering of $8 trillion in futile wars in the West Asia North Africa region illustrate. War and sanctions, it is believed, will cripple countries rich in gas, oil, and natural resources. War or the threat of war will curb the growing economic and military clout. These are demented and dangerous fantasies perpetrated by a ruling class that has severed itself from reality. No longer able to salvage their own society and economy, they seek to destroy those of their global competitors. Once the militaries cripple countries, the plan goes they will focus military aggression on the Indo-Pacific, dominating what Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, referring to the Pacific, called the American Sea. You cannot talk about war without talking about markets. The United States, whose growth rate has fallen to below 2%, while China's growth rate is 8.1%, has turned to military aggression to bolster its sagging economy.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio, and this is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have with us in studio today our guest speaker, Brother Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing.
It's always a pleasure being here.
Thank you so much for being with us. Brother Al-Musawi, as we discussed in last session, a parent used a term scolding, which you said contains a lot of negative connotation it has with it. And you said, instead of scolding our children, we need to educate them. We need to fix the problem. I would want you to expand a little more on the topic.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Previously, we were saying that when it comes to kids misbehaving, instead of punishing them or scolding them, we need to help them. And we help them by finding out what causes them to be in this position to begin with, what made the child do what he did. So instead of me trying to fix the action itself, let me fix the pre-action itself, if we can say the least. So we mentioned a number of reasons why children end up misbehaving that we need to look at. So from a personal level, when it comes to the children, we mentioned a few things, and inshallah, I would like to mention a few more in this regard. So the parents have a clearer picture of why kids misbehave, because a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. They think that the child misbehaved because he's a bad child. We don't have such a thing as a bad child. Like Allah says in the hadith, or the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam says in the hadith, that everyone is born on the fitrah. And it's up to the parents to make him a Jew or a Christian. So everyone is born on this pure innate that Allah has given them. Yeah. It's up to the parents to send them whatever direction. Then again, when we look at children and we see why they're misbehaving, we have a number of reasons. Like I said, we mentioned a few of them. And let us mention a few more. One of the reasons children misbehave is the fact they conclude to the wrong decision or to the wrong conclusion, if we can say the least, right? And that's obviously a lack of their understanding of things. So sometimes when a child does something, he thinks it's a good thing. So sometimes I remember one day I came to the bathroom and I found my daughter washing, like she was putting the iPad in the, in the spa.
Wash basin?
Yeah.
All right.
Like she filled up the spa and she was putting the iPad in. I'm like, what are you doing, Habibti? She's like, Dad, I'm washing and it's too dirty. So, I mean, that's her conclusion of cleaning that iPad. And it never worked again, right? It's her idea of cleaning is to put it in water. Now, I can't, if I was a... A terrible father, the first thing I would do is slap her.
Exactly.
Right? You just put $600 in a water, right?
Yeah.
But I said, no, hi, this is not how you work. This is not how you clean it. I was like, oh, but I'm like, yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm like,
so
but now it's not going to work, right?
So kind of you.
Yeah, so, and then so she was like, but that doesn't work now. I'm like, well, that's what you do if you put it in water. So now she learned the lesson herself. So she reached
after experimenting.
Exactly. So sometimes children and even youth reach the wrong conclusion by themselves. So instead of me trying to punish them for this conclusion that they've reached, let me try to fix how they can think correctly, which is a very important part of a child's life and upbringing and their education. Trying to look at the cause rather than the problem. Because if you try to punish the problem will keep repeating itself. You know, like when a person is sick, if you keep giving him painkillers, you will numb the pain for a while. But
you are not
back.
Actually going to treat the disease itself.
Yeah, not
itself.
Treating it. It will come back right after the medication wears off.
Yes.
And then you take another pill.
Yes.
Until when? Until we completely die out. You
yes.
know what I mean? So we can't keep doing that. Like I always say, we can't have a Band-Aid solution to things.
Yes.
You need to actually fix the problem.
Fix the problem itself. Brother Musawi, I'll continue the session with you after a very short while. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have brother Al-Musafi with me, and we are talking about fixing a problem rather than looking for some painkiller kind of remedies. So, brother, you rightly mentioned that a painkiller does numb the pain for some time, but it does not actually treat the problem.
Yeah. So from here, we have to once again go back to the source of the problem and try to fix it from the beginning rather than just try to patch it up, which is not going to work. Another reason to why kids misbehave and do bad things is they are isolated. And sometimes as parents, we take a joy when a child isolates himself because we say, okay, got good riddance, right? I get a break now. He's away. I can do whatever I want. Hey, the child's not bugging me. Now, that's a problem. When the child is isolated and he's by himself and talks to himself and plays with himself, he will feel, you know, he will feel like an alien in a planet. And as a result, he will do a lot of things that he should not do. So
yeah.
As a parent, we should not take isolation and being himself and talking to himself and playing by himself as always a good sign. We say, yes, we encourage children to speak out loud. We encourage children to have imaginary friends, but not to isolate themselves, because isolation always going to backfire at us. Because I've seen a lot of parents, they get very happy when the children are isolated. And now when the child starts to cry or the child starts to annoy the parents, you know what they do? They give him the phone and the tablet's like, all right, just go play.
Again, they, isolating.
Yeah, so we deliberately isolating our children so we could get a bit of comfort, which is a problem. So isolation itself is a big problem itself. Another reason why children misbehave is that sometimes children themselves, they face a problem and they don't know how to solve it, and they don't have the capacity to come and talk with their parents about it. Because most of the times, as parents, we put ourselves in an authority figure kind of person where they look at you as authority. If they always do that, then they will find it very hard to come to you with their problems. So you need to play it safe. You need to maintain your authority figure. At the same time, you bring yourself to their level where they feel comfortable talking to you. So you see, girls, for example, they're very comfortable talking to their moms about their personal issues from the outside. For example, if she's in love with a boy, she will come tell her mom. She will never tell her dad.
Yeah.
Because she's constantly looking at the father as an authority figure. So she's just scared from him. Well, the mother has no authority figure. She's just a friend. And in both cases, they're both wrong.
Yes.
So you need to maintain this authority figure. At the same time, you make it easy for them. So you befriend them as much as an authority figure. So the problem is the people with the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, or with, even with the imams, they say that they have this haiba of nubuwa, or the haiba of imam, this aroma that makes us, you know, very, you know, it doesn't make it easy for us to approach them.
Mm-hmm.
Yet their akhlaq is so down to earth, it makes it very easy for us to sit with them.
Yes.
So maintaining that.
Indeed, both, that down-to-earthness.
Yeah, thing. So with parents, the same thing. So kids face problem on their own, and sometimes if they can't find the right ear to talk to, then that's a problem. So it will manifest on their action on the outside.
Yes, definitely. Brother, I'll be talking to you after a very short while. Here we need to take a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have with me in studio Brother Al-Musawi. Brother Al-Musawi, you said that parents actually need to keep in mind nothing good comes without giving up something. Like sometimes you said parents have to give up a lot of things. Like if they want to be in isolation, in relaxation mode themselves, they don't have to isolate their children. Sometimes if there's a problem with the children, maybe a child is actually trying to pursue attention-seeking behavior. So what are other things you think that parents need to keep in mind?
All right. So there are other signs that the parents need to pay attention to when it comes to their kids. For example, when they see their kids, sometimes you have a very, I wouldn't say brave kids, but kids who are, they go overboard, like they don't they have no fear. They do whatever they want. Like they break things, they put themselves in harm's way, they just don't care. Because yeah, sometimes the parents, they take this as a sign of bravery. Oh, my child's so brave, he does this. And there's a difference between being brave and being a fool.
Yes.
Right? So when you see a child being very foolish, doing things that are foolish, that's not bravery. So yeah, any foolish action from a child is also a sign, an indication that there's something wrong. And sometimes we have like physical signs where kids grow up even to, you know, when they early like 10, 11, 12, and they still wet the bed, for example. A child who wets the bed even above a 3 or 4, that's a problem. right? Children who are constantly biting their nails and biting their fingers or sucking their fingers, this is also a problem. When kids, for example, are always angry, always yelling, always crying, that indicates that our problem with a child that needs to be fixed. Kids constantly have doubts about things. Kids constantly complaining about things. Kids constantly not happy about things. These are all indications that we have a very unhealthy child. So as parents, we should not only look at these things and say, well, you know, I let it go. He will, yeah, it's just a phase. He will get over it. No, he won't. It's a problem. When, for example,
as a parent, I need to figure it out.
Yeah, so sometimes you have children, for example, I've seen this many times where children, they break their toys.
Yes.
They break things. They just have a habit of breaking things.
Breaking things.
That's a problem. That stems from a problem within the child. Or when you see, for example, the child taking the toys of other kids.
Yes.
And they take joy in it. You know, they take it from them and they laugh at them. That's a problem. Bullying is a problem.
Yes.
So we have a lot of issues that we need to monitor in our children. So like I said, children are a trust. We need to maintain this trust and keep an eye on them.
Yes.
Otherwise, we will definitely lose them.
Yes. Thank you so much, Brother Mousavi, for being with us. Thank you so much for such a beautiful discussion, giving us so many signs and symptoms parents can think about. Even I'm still in thoughts to figure out a lot of things that you said we need to look out of a lot of signs, which may be a sign of a problem, which may be yelling at us, there is a problem with your child, we need to figure that out, rather than scolding and just being lecturing our children. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you
Pleasure.
So much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us. Please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our sessions again on our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.